Okay, so let's talk about prayer. It's a big topic. I'm trying to figure out where to begin. Let's begin in the Torah itself. So if you're talking around 1200 BCE, and we're between Genesis and Deuteronomy, we're in the Torah books, there is no prayer as we know it today. So there's no kind of like you go and you say a bunch of words and then you leave. So worship is built around sacrifice. And although actually there is a set of words we often ignore. So I'll get to that in a second. Maybe that's a good place to start. Maybe it's a neglected place to start. The cliche that we say in books and intro to Judaism classes is that prayer replaced sacrifice once animal sacrifice went away with the destruction of the temple under the Romans. Let's see if that's really true. So that
doesn't sound like it. They're not equivalent at all.
Right. I mean, they certainly don't seem to be equivalent. Let's think about what going to the temple meant prior to its destruction. And in the Torah itself, there's no temple in Jerusalem per se, but there is the portable sanctuary, which the permanent temple in Jerusalem is based on. So when you went to the temple, when you went into the portable sanctuary, the tabernacle, in Hebrew, the Mishkan, the description of building it is in Exodus and Leviticus, and the execution of its building is in Leviticus and its inauguration, and then it goes on. There are public sacrifices by the priests in honor, essentially, of holidays, including Shabbat. And then there are personal sacrifices made by people. There are essentially seven types of sacrifice, more or less. One of them, the Olah, is a sacrifice that entirely belongs to God, and that's the one that's made publicly on behalf of the priests for a holiday or on the Sabbath. But most of the rest of them are personal sacrifices. Can be brought. Three of them relate to making reparation with God for personal failings or sins. I just hate the word sin, but making reparation with God. So they're, you know, we call it atonement, but it's reparations. So if you have done a wrong, either intentional or unintentional, you can bring some kind of an offering. It doesn't have to be as big as a goat or something like that. It can be a pigeon. We're very common offerings. It could even be bread. So you could bring bread, and on certain holidays, you could bring produce. So it doesn't have to be an animal, but you would bring an offering, and for reparation offerings, they would be distributed among the priests and the Levites who do the sacrifices and among the poor and the needy. So they were like donation reparations. Also, very commonly, the sacrifices, particularly the shalem or shalom offering, the peace offering, was just because you wanted to eat meat. And prior to toward the end of the book of Deuteronomy, initially any meat has to be sacrificed within the temple, within the portable tabernacle. So for any meat eating, the animal would be brought, it would be called a peace offering, and the priests would take certain organs and certain parts of the cut for themselves and for the poor, and then the rest of it would be returned to the person who brought it, and that would be the meat that they get to eat, a large portion of the animal, and there's either a 24-hour limit or a 48-hour limit on how long you have to eat the meat or before it has to be discarded. And so that one way to think of this, and I know I'm not even at prayer yet, and I don't want to get too off topic, but that if the origins of this are in a shepherd spirituality, then even when you have private animals that belong to you, I mean, you have your private herd or your private animals, your private stock. When you call the herd, it is not a private affair. So when an animal in a shepherd culture is actually killed, it becomes public. And it becomes, in a way, sacred. It becomes something that gets associated with something larger than you and your family. And
even when they're alive, so they are, because you have to, the leaders have to take into accounting what will be needed for such a mass of creatures. And
true, that it has to be a very conscious process, when you're culling the herd and how you're doing so. Because you're right, if you cull the herd too early, then you have no adult animals, and so on and so forth. And also, I admit, I'm not an expert in shepherd animal husbandry, and I don't want to make it up, but those decisions are logical and rational decisions that are part of a system. But mostly, and this is something I've argued over and over again, because I think it's core to my spirituality and my core beliefs, is that it makes eating meat a special occasion.
As it should be.
Correct. And the Book of Leviticus states very clearly, although it's mostly misread, in the Book of Leviticus, prior to having all of this worked out, it says that when you take the life of an animal, you're guilty of murder, and so that you basically have the death penalty upon you, and the only way to make atonement for the murder of the animal is to do it under God's instruction. So you have one way of doing it in which it is permitted. And that way is you actually acknowledge that the soul doesn't belong to you. The soul belongs to God. The word for soul and life are the same thing here, nephesh. So it's the word soul in the same way as when you say that 20 souls were lost on board the ship that went down. So the life force doesn't belong to you. If you take it, you've stolen from God and stolen from the animal. You've committed murder, and your life is forfeit. But here, if you acknowledge within the construct of the sacrifice that it is at the central altar, that's where the murder will take place, or unless you're hunting. And there's another system for when you're hunting, where you basically do a mini version of the ceremony for game animals that you've hunted, so that when you kill the animal in the game, you pour out the blood upon the earth, whereas the priests pour out the blood upon the altar. And so you do your own private ceremony when hunting that mirrors the public ceremony. And you acknowledge that you say, I return the life to God from which it comes, and this meat will be shared, and it will be eaten in a very, very timely fashion. It basically makes meat eating rare within a culture that lives off of the dairy products of animals. So that when you're living off of goat cheese and goat milk and all of those goat kind of dairy products, or in our culture, the cow products for someone like me, I mean, I don't know if I can get through a day without getting most of my protein from milk and forms of milk. And as you know, we're an unusual species because most species stop having milk once they're weaned, and yet we live off of the milk of animals. And you can either say that's a weird thing, or you could say this is one of the most important steps in our evolution.
Arguably, or both.
You missed out on that step?
Life is intolerant, yeah.
But as a species, it was, in a way, a special gift from God in our evolution that we figured all this out, that we developed herding and milking, and we live off of the milk of animals, is extraordinary, and it allows for the development of civilization. Within all of those contexts, you have...
It's also a compromise, though, because people shouldn't have to take lives of animals in order to sustain themselves. That was
correct.
Just God saying, you guys are a little immature right now. I'll abridge my own rules and let you work around it for now.
That's the argument. The argument is that this is an ongoing rabbinic debate that you and I have our opinions of that I think are the right ones. But the ongoing debate is whether vegetarianism is sort of clearly the highest form of what God wants. And the evidence for that is substantial, although people on the other side think we're making this, that we're exaggerating. But the evidence is substantial. The evidence is that in the Garden of Eden, everyone's vegetarian. So that why would they have to say that? But it kind of makes sense. You have the animals, and right. It wasn't until Noah. And right, and then the wording of that concession after the flood with Noah, that you're going to eat the animals you just saved and they're going to eat you, is in the context is not a positive context, and it's extraordinarily negative context. Noah, you know, like has just sinned by being his nakedness has been uncovered by his sons. It is the world that God hoped to purify through the flood seems almost immediately God to realize that that world will not be purified, because immediately following that's the Tower of Babel and Sodom and Gomorrah. So the whole project of the Noah's Ark has failed. The world seems to have become, again, even worse of a lawless place of murder and killing and violence. And exactly what God came to stop. So what God seems to say, that context is, my flood didn't work. I can't breed good people. So killing all the bad people and saving Noah's family, so that it's a giant eugenics experiment. And, you know, people, and that's an ugly word since Hitler, and it is ugly. The beautiful thing is in the Torah, like, it was tried and rejected, which is God's like, can we, and but to this day, I mean, whether it's the Trump rhetoric or other things, can we just breed the good people? You know, I mean, on some level, there's this tribalism that goes back to it. But no, everyone has their own nature and their own free will. So what seems to happen is that God, the context here is God says, I can't breed the good ones. So this kind of human beings being bent on Hamas, on evil and murder and robbery and theft and selfishness is natural. It's exactly what God said he would wipe out with the flood, but then doesn't get wiped out. And then God says, so you know what now? You've always been vegetarian. My command has always been to be vegetarian. But now you eat meat, but they're also going to eat you. Like, this is going to be the violent, right? It's a shameful allowance.
Lighter backpack than
and I then initially. God's basically saying, I'm going to have to overcome this violence and injustice that pervades humanity in a different way. The Catholic Church has an answer later for getting rid of it. But, I mean, in the Torah, we have our own way of getting rid of it, which is, it's going to have to be established through a new tribal system, like through social justice. I mean, what we call social justice, which today sounds like almost a quaint word, but it's the whole principle of, it's going to come back, and it's the whole principle of the Torah, which is that what if hungry people got fed? Maybe they wouldn't kill for food. Like, if you could eliminate scarcity, maybe you could eliminate some Hamas. If you could have Sure.
The word that you're saying for evil is not related to the Purim story.
Yes, it is in the Purim story.
But it's a person's name, not.
Oh no! That not. Haman is the name of the evil person. Haman. The word Hamas comes up in the Purim story, but it's not related in a way to Haman. It's weird. The weird thing is, it's the name of the Palestinian terrorist wing, is Hamas. And the strange thing is that it's a different word. It sounds exactly like the Hebrew word for violence and killing. But it's actually from a different root in Arabic, and it means something else for Hamas. So it's fascinating that it is a holy coincidence. But it's this root for social crime. And so then the Torah has all these kinds of mechanisms to kind of create a system in which that those actions are not only are suppressed and eliminated to the greatest extent possible. So by eliminating scarcity, by creating a justice system, which is created in the book of Deuteronomy, which is a big deal. I mean, to stop tribal revenge. I mean, a whole part of the Torah is committed to stopping tribal revenge killings and personal family clan justice. So clan justice becomes replaced in Deuteronomy with a kind of police force, an investigation force, and a proper military. And these things are all considered part of God's way of eliminating the violence and the crime. But going back to vegetarianism, and I know we're going back to sacrifice, so that initially it was, if you're going to cull the herd, you would, go ahead. No, I sent you one thing about the laptop. That was it.
Yeah, and I got the other one too.
Thank you. That's it. I have to say one other tangent, which is just too good to resist, which is this. We don't think enough. And it goes to the holiday of Yom Kippur. We don't think enough about this idea that if you have made a mistake or a sin or done something wrong in your personal life, why is it that you would bring an offering to God, a sacrifice to God?
Because when you go against the way things are meant to be, first off, it's offensive to somebody who could see how everything is supposed to be the right way.
Mm-hmm.
And second off, it's offensive because you're twisting yourself out of how you're meant to be.
Nicely said. So you're saying that, I'll do the second one first, that on the one hand, it's an apology to God that these words don't capture it, but it's something like an apology to God because you've twisted yourself out of what God wants from you. Excellent. And then the first thing you said, which is the truth, which is that when we talk about the right way to be, I'm not arguing that the Torah gives you such a clear algorithm that, like, we can all become automata. But there is a right way to be in terms of, so it's not that exact.
Well, there's lots of different streams. If the
correct
right way to be is don't steal stuff.
Correct.
There are many ways of getting what you need that doesn't include stealing.
Right. And then see, more than that, that the Torah is trying to create something like a symbiotic ecosystem for a human tribe and a human society, so that while there's enormous amounts of freedom within it, still, if you were, if it's like an anthill that we look down on, that God could look down on a human anthill, it's not that we're so clearly defined, you are the drone and you are the queen, but nevertheless, you could look at the ecosystem and see that nature is not being destroyed, the poor are not being ignored, women who get raped are not screaming out and having no one answer them. And these are actual examples all through the Torah, where these are some of the laws which have to do with, you know, these very specific examples. So that
it brings home things that were so immature, again,
right,
a way of thinking about it. If you hurt somebody else, you should hurt also in empathy with that.
Good. So that if you've hurt someone else, you should hurt in empathy with that, which could be the idea of personal sacrifice. But if you view it as I do, I like to use the word reparations, is that if I spread gossip to you right now about, you know, someone, I could just realize, you know what, I shouldn't have spread gossip. I tell you later, you know what, I shouldn't have said that about that person. I feel bad about it. But when you then make the sacrifice to God, what you're doing is you're saying that my actions affect the entire system. And to me, that is, in a way, the greatest statement of faith, what I would call Jewish faith. As you know, I find a lot of value in contrasting Jewish faith with the early Catholic Church. I'm not talking about Martin Luther King's theology or Meister Eckhart, but like classic early Catholicism and really evangelical Christianity has a very different idea of faith. But our sort of faith in what God is that God is the entire system in which we live. And so that every breath I take and every action I do ripples all the way through God. You know, when I hear on the radio some scientist on a TED talk saying, you do realize you're breathing the same air that the dinosaurs breathed. And I'm like, holy crap, really? Like, is he making that up? He's like, I am not making that up. Like, that blows my mind. That's what sacrifice is supposed to do. It's supposed to be that I am so small, and it seems that my actions are so invisible and so trivial, but the Torah is saying they truly are not. Like, you are literally part of the God system. And as a Jew, you are part of this, as you said, this really long-term plan of formulating a society that will evolve, because again, it's not like an algorithm. You say, you do this, you do this, you do this, and we're all good. It's these sets of laws and principles that over time are supposed to eliminate violence and things like that and create an ecosystem that when God looks down, we are in balance with nature. We are in balance with each other. Yes. God says there are two commands there's one command that says there shall be no needy among you. And there's another command that says there will always be needy among you, and which is a way of saying, like, you're working to eliminate the needy, but it doesn't mean that it can ever be completely eliminated. But there's this process in which I should be looking down, just like the body can absorb bacteria and eliminate it. You may never get rid of all bacteria, but that's also true. God should be able to look at the human society and see that it's functioning correctly in terms of dealing with pathogen and violence and crime and mental illness. And,
in the future is at the same level as
good point.
Middle or upper people now.
Then that's a serious problem. Exactly. That's true. So I do think that sacrifice initially was, at its spiritual core, an acknowledgement that personal action is meaningful to God, and I translate that theologically as saying that you have an effect on the massive system. And I really don't think that people walk around today understanding this. I mean, I think that if I go home, and I used to have a problem with exaggeration, and I've shared it with my congregants before. It's one of my greatest successes in my life was I made a conscious decision back in the late 90s that I wanted to eliminate exaggeration from my vocabulary or whatever. And I have it from my speaking. And I'm not saying it's 100% eliminated, but I consciously made the decision to do it. I worked on it. To me, it's like drinking or something. It's like I consciously was like, just every time I did it, I corrected myself. It was just that simple. When I said, oh, it was like 15 years ago, Barbara, that it was 7 years ago. And that it was just, I made myself correct myself. The reason I'm saying this is that, what does it matter if I told you something 15 years ago, Barbara, I had this thing happen to me versus 7 years ago? How could that possibly matter to God? How could that possibly matter to the social system? How could that affect an Eskimo? How could that? But it's a lie and it's wrong. But I actually do believe it affects people at a distance. That it is like introducing a pathogen into the soup. It's like introducing something foreign into the pond. You can always look at things and say, how could me exaggerating to Barbara in the privacy of a study session ever affect the rest of the world? But it does change me. It could change you. I become a liar. I become an exaggerator. It makes exaggerating okay. I could spread it to my children. Like, exaggerating is a form of evil speech. It is technically, it's a form of lying, and it's lying. Lying is bad. So, like, I do think that the reparations to the community through saying, I'm going to pay something that's going to get shared with those who serve the community and those who are poor, it's actually a beautiful acknowledgement of one's connection to God, because one is saying that my actions affect, and you could say it's negative, my actions affect the world. My negative actions affect the world.
On the other hand, these days it's easier than ever to be like, it's just lines on a screen. Who really cares what I write on the computer?
Correct.
Or I'm only going to see these people for an hour each week at this class that I go to, so who really cares what they think about me? They're not real people, like the people that, you know, are in my family that are real.
I mean, you know, I saw a billboard the other day that said, would you like to save 1,500 gallons of water? Don't eat a burger for lunch. I mean, people think nothing about eating a burger. And if I said, you not eating that burger could change the world, they think I'm crazy. And then if I say, do you know it takes 1,500 gallons of water to produce one quarter pounder? I think they would say so much. You know, so what? I'm like, 1,500 gallons of water in a world that's globally warming, where a lot of people don't have clean water to drink, and which that water, it's rainforest that's cut down to raise herds in Chile and Brazil and Argentina. So there's no more like biodiversity, you know, and the animals cruelly treated. You don't think any of this affects the universe? Like, it's all, like, you should take a sacrifice to apologize for your hamburger. I mean, like, and yet people can't think that way. But I think people have to think that way if the world's going to change. And some people think that way. And a lot, and they're made fun of for it, but those are the people I think who get God. Those are the people and they're just made fun of. But, you know, serving a congregation, I can see entirely different ways of thinking where people are just shocked at these kinds of ideas. So anyway, but I want to move on a little bit. So you've got sacrifice as you enter into the public realm. It's not private. You deliver your item. It's put on the altar and it's shared with people that need it. And if you do want to eat meat for your own life, for the shalom offering, it's really the shalem offering. It's the same root word, but slightly different meaning. But it's usually translated the peace offering. Then if you are going to cull the herd, if you're going to take that life of the animal, then it should be in such a way that benefits the community. So you're going to get a bunch of the meat, but some of it's going to go to the community. It's also going to be a public thing. You don't kill animals in private, which would be a great lesson today. And you hold on to the animal while it's being slaughtered, so you have a sense in which this is something that you take agency and responsibility for. And then normally these are public banquets. You kill animals on special, if you're going to kill an animal, you make it a special occasion. It's a baby born. It's a birth. It's a wedding. It's a birthday party. It's a celebration. It's something larger than yourself. And these are the origins of the holidays in some ways. It's a special day and we would do sacrifices and feasting and it was very communal. It was sharing. It was public and you have to eat the meat within a day or two because you can't hoard it. And it forces you to share every part of the animal. So rather than have the meat go bad because you saved it and hoarded it, you're like commanded in a way not to hoard it. Because it's like, you've got a 24-hour clock ticking. So if that stuff is going, you know, like, or a 48-hour clock, depending on which sacrifice it is. And then you're like, uh-oh, distribute it. And a lot of, so I just want to point out, this is where a lot of people say something like, these were just ways to keep people from getting sick back in the old days. And so it's just archaic hygiene laws. This is a classic way of making the Torah go away. As I put it, you're making the Torah sound smart, you think, by making it sound stupid. Like you're really saying it's just a stupid old hygiene law. Well, of course it had hygiene as a part of it, but it was also like, well, although by the way, I think they had smoking and salting technologies that you could keep meat going for a long time. Exactly. But it's not hygiene laws. The Torah would say they want people to be, you know, not get sick. But it's forced sharing. I mean, you're basically forced to give away the food. I think it's wonderful.
If yourself clean was supposed to be the lesson, then it would be placed in terms that carried on to now, such as, you know, make sure that when you salt meat, this is how we do it. And when you
correct. This is a big, and one of the differences between Reform and conservative and Orthodox Judaism is that Reform has traditionally taken the position that a lot of the stuff is just proto-science. It's early hygiene stuff. Again, you make the Bibles. Jews were smart back then. We knew how not to get sick. But it's really just a fancy rationalization for none of this applies today. And I'm not going to look any deeper into it. It's certainly what we call a reductio ad absurdum. I mean, you're just reducing it to something that might have been a part of it, but, you know, I mean, it would be like saying people come to synagogue because they need a place to sit. Well, you can sit somewhere else. But, you know, but yes, we have chairs so people can sit. But that's not the reason they're coming, is to sit. So it's kind of a logic issue.
Disregarding the absolute fabric.
Exactly. So
context matters.
So I will do something I rarely do, which is I would love to follow more of the evolution of sacrifice into prayer, right? But let's jump ahead. So I will open it up to you. So instead of following just the historical evolution of how, in a sense, prayer replaced sacrifice, let's go the other route, which is, so for what we've already said about sacrifice, what could prayer be about today that is continuing those themes? Because I want to say that I don't think 99.9% of people who come in to pray at synagogue know what the purpose is. It's something we do. But it's not clear what it's meant to do. In other words, it's not something we talk consciously about. Why are we consciously doing this? What would be the connections?
And some of it is, I mean, having to do with just religion. This is a thing that you do in a religion. And a huge portion of it is social, though, because you come to see and be seen. And you come because how else are you going to teach the young of the community the manner in which we behave? And it transmits history, and I'm thinking of a concept of together like you were saying last time about how if you took, you know, 4th of July elsewhere, you know, what are, or if you took an American elsewhere and said, what are some aspects of being an American? Well, same thing. If you're not gathered together in order to pray, how are you going to learn ever how to do it and why and how to do it in the future?
So let me say that one again, even though you said it very well, which is culture is by its nature social. And in a way, one of the amazing things is that with the Mishkan, the tabernacle, the temple, it created the possibility of culture because people had to go there to do it. And you had to see and be seen. And today, I don't want to make this a straw man argument, but culture in some ways is viewed as not necessarily something that has to happen publicly. In other words, I could say, well, I have Irish heritage. And so that means a lot to me.
But it's claiming a particular thing.
But I'm claiming something, but I'm not doing anything Irish.
Right.
Like, in other words, Americans have a tendency to make about themselves everything. So that, you know, somehow I feel a connection to Irish culture, but culture is something that by nature is something that is done publicly. So if you're not participating in it, you really don't have any claim to it, and it doesn't continue. It becomes just nostalgia. So the temple, you had to go and be in public in order to do your offerings, and you had to see and be seen. I mean, to the point where if you look at the temple in Jerusalem and you visit Jerusalem, you'll notice at the base of the temple hill, it's built on an artificial mount. I mean, there's a little hill, but then they beefed up the hill with dirt and stone. And you'll notice down below there are two doors that lead to a stairway inside the wall that lead up to the top where the base of the temple is. And one of the things about those doors is that for people that weren't within a period of mourning, there's an entrance and an exit. One is to go up and one is to come down. If you were in the period of mourning, you would actually go through the exit. And when you're ready to exit, you would go down through the entrance. And that is something very similar to going to synagogue today, which is to say your Kaddish for your loved one, you have to do it in a minyan, meaning that death becomes public, that you have to see and be seen. So you're the people coming, you know, it's like climbing the Statue of Liberty. If you've ever done something like that, there's a stairway that goes up through the wall to get to the thing. And the people, so you know, anyone who's coming up the down stairway, you'd be like, hey, I know you. You're my cousin's relative from the Galilee. And you're like, yeah, what happened? And you're like, you know, my mother died. And God forbid. So it was forcing both you to be public about something that today is often considered private, like grief, and it was a way of letting the news get... Right, go ahead.
It also elicits reactions, which creates stronger community bonding.
I agree.
If everybody has to know that so-and-so had a relative who passed, and so-and-so had a really bad harvest, or, you know, all of these bad things, well, then they could be lifted up.
I agree, and I think that... So the idea is that instead of a private grief, which is a lot of what we do today, and of course, much of grief still is private back then, you have to see and be seen, meaning you have to let people know that in a way death is public, that in a way loss is public, and you also have to see in the sense that you can't hide. So by seeing, you have to reintegrate into society. So if you compare that stairway to the mourner's Kaddish today, the prayer in the prayer book that you can't say by yourself and is the memorial prayer, and you say it for somewhere between a month and a year for an immediate relative who has died, then I see it as a very similar thing. You have to come here. You have to see us. We have to be like, oh my gosh, I didn't realize, you know, that this has happened. And you also have to normalize. In a way, you can't just, you know, it's healthy. And so you're reintegrating into the society, but you're also different. And, you know, those people can reach out to you. So culture is something that happens socially. And so I would say that this is an example where it's not the sacrifice that's, you can't, you don't want to make a cliche. You say, well, your sacrifice is replaced by words. Like, you're living in some kind of, you're trying to turn
it's
some, yeah, it's a linchpin. Right. I mean, because people love simplistic theological statements. Well, you know that, and even Jews do. Yeah, well, you know, the animals we now sacrifice our words. I don't even know what that means. You know what I mean? Oh, well, we used to offer animals, now we offer words. It's much more complex. It has to do, as you said, with, which in a way was number two of two things, which is that there's a social aspect to the culture that has many dimensions. And this is an example where you could say the Mourner's Kaddish replaces a temple visit.
Until the words mean nothing.
Right.
Because nobody will understand them anymore. Or they'll have mutated so far beyond what they used to be that they're not even related anymore.
And I agree. And then a whole nother dimension, just going back to this, the reparations thing, is I think that for me, like private prayer in a synagogue is reflected, you know, it involves these grand themes of my role in God's system, that my actions matter to God, by which I mean that they have an effect far beyond the scope that I see. And I need to take responsibility of that, for that. That was the reparation offerings that formed the temple, and I think that's a lot of what prayer is about. Just right there is that. Otherwise, like, why pray a bunch of prayers? They're not about me getting through my day. They're not about, well, you know what? Prayer's for people that need prayer. You know, like, religion's for people that need something to believe in or need security or whatever, but it's not for me. I mean, that's absurd. Because it trivializes. It's just saying, oh, you know, people need to pray, and that's like some kind of, right. God, like, right. So prayer is not for God. It's for us. But it is for changing our lives, to remember our relationship to the whole system. So we read teachings in the prayer book that remind us of our connection to everyone else and to the whole system in which we live, which is this vast system of life and energy and purpose and connection.
What you were talking about on Saturday also, about how words mean things.
Right.
If you say out loud prayers, whichever kind you're saying, you're letting out that energy amongst everybody else who can hear you, and they'll say, if that guy wants to be a better person, we could hear him, and we acknowledge that, and that's the way it's going to be.
So I'll take it one step back, which is absolutely the prayer, that words, that one of the definitions of the human being in our tradition, it's not the only one, but it's one of the main ones by the rabbis in the Talmud, is that the thing that is special about the human being is not our level of intelligence. Because, you know, what if we find out that dolphins are more intelligent than we are? You know what I mean? For real.
Yes.
It is this language thing, that we are language makers and language understanders, and it's our big thing. And I love this, because if you read, you know, one of my heroes, who is Noam Chomsky, who's actually a friend of my father's growing up, he's the guy who revolutionized linguistics. And if you ever get to read any Chomsky, it's amazing stuff. But Chomsky changed the whole field of linguistics in the late 20th century, actually mid-20th century, because he argued something that was the opposite of what was believed. It was believed that language acquisition was a learned behavior. And what he showed was that it had to be genetic. And in a time where we're talking about, like, pre-genetics, you know what I mean? The 1960s, we're like pre-genetics. And what he basically showed basically by studying languages all over the world, is they follow algorithms, syntaxes that have an underlying structure that are common to all languages. And that the only possible explanation for this is that we are genetically predisposed. We carry these algorithms inside our genes. And all of it's been validated. Then he completely, like, you know, he's considered one of the giants of the 20th century, still alive now. And that accords with the Bible, that we were given, or this Talmudic view, that there was this special, like, evolutionary gift we were given. Like I talked about the ability to digest milk beyond weaning years for most people.
And the voice boxes of verbal birds are different from the voice boxes of nonverbal, though sound-producing birds.
Wow. But it's okay. I'm just saying, I'm sure that we carry within us the ability to have very complex language, and that we create culture and we create everything out of this language. Now, if you agree with those rabbis who say that is our most essential trait, not that we can use our thumb, not that we walk vertically, not even that we're so damn smart, you know, or that we can use tools. If what makes us special is that we carry the ability to have vast worlds of words and communicate with each other, then how we communicate and how we use those words is, in a way, one of the most important things that God's looking at us about. And that to put it simply, we live in the worlds that we create by our words as much as we live in the world of objects. And that's the essential thing I was arguing from the book of Numbers, where you have a series of things by the, and in Leviticus, by the priestly source, by what's called P. But it's the priestly recording of our history and our ancient teachings. And the priestly source is all about that you don't realize it, but you are living in the world of your words and, as much as objects, because the way you see the world is filtered through your concepts and your language. So you don't see an object, you see a chair. You don't see skin, you see your spouse. And these are socially mediated concepts. And so that you're experiencing, you can't distinguish between the world as it is and the world that is created through language. And one of the great thing, I studied it for years, but I'm studying it for years to understand that that philosophy came around to this too, which is you can't create a language that doesn't have interpretation built into it. And on some level, you can try, and you can create certain kinds of mathematical and structured scientific languages and math. But so if that's the case, then if we could spend a little bit of time each day thinking about words and how we use our words, and to practice using words well, it can completely change your life. And that's another view of prayer. Another view of prayer is it's practicing using words. And these prayers help you practice, in a way, constructing the world correctly and thinking. And by saying words and thinking about them in a meaningful way, you create a template that you can enter. But, like those people who say, I don't need prayer to do that. I just want to live a good life. But then that's like saying I can do the Indy 500 without ever stopping for gas. Like, at some point you have to stop and say, let me, purify my thoughts. Let me use my words. So, some of the prayers, we have a liturgy. You can pray in whatever words you want, but the prayer forms a kind of purification ceremony of your thoughts through saying words.
To live a good life, mm-hmm. Might eventually not understand what that is because they're only talking to themselves through themselves.
Correct. You're right. I love what you just said. So the person who thinks they're just trying to live a good life can lose their way.
My younger daughter, I told you about her before, she was nonverbal. She did sign language first. And when she was growing up, my whole family looks approximately like me, darkish of hair and lightish of skin. Those are humans. Those are people. People with light-colored hair are aberrations. They were bad and they were wrong.
Mm-hmm.
People with dark-colored skin, they're teddy bears. Because that's the only frame of reference that she had. She had to grow into words and concepts before we could explain, no. Same thing, just different varieties.
Wow, that's amazing.
People inherently try and sort things out according to what they know, but I can't sit there and be like, no, person. If that's not a concept that they'll filter through. Can't say you're going to lead a good life and not have that filtered through, because if they think bad things are good things, or at least acceptable, what kind of life?
No, that's right. Okay, I'm just reflecting on what you said. So, let's take a look at some of the prayers and think about what they mean. So we don't have to do everything in the context of replacing sacrifice, but there is something to be said for there was a function that was served that connected people to God and to each other that we now do through services or through worship. And so let's look at page, I don't think of a good one. I'm tempted to do my old-fashioned one, which you've already read in my guide to the morning service, which I know you've read. So I don't want to, I don't want to just repeat something you've heard, unless there's a way to do it kind of quickly.
Unless it was English, I probably didn't understand it, so it's okay.
Okay, well, let's do this then. Let's take a look at the Saturday morning service, and starting on 104. And I'm going to do a quick version of my familiar guide to our congregants about how the Saturday morning service works. And you probably read it. It's on the table at the front of the sanctuary. So it goes like this, which is that prior to page 104, we've just had warm-up prayers. The idea is that you can't just say, okay, I'm ready to pray. And it took me a long time to realize this, but I think that's true. I mean, you have to warm up to play music. You have to warm up sometimes to give a lecture or to teach. And you need to warm up so that everything that comes before this in the service is essentially warming up our voices and our minds, chasing sleepiness and fatigue, and what the rabbis called, it's a very, very important Jewish concept that we don't talk about enough, but they called it alien thoughts. So the idea is that we want to distinguish between the thoughts we want to be having and the thoughts that come, right, exactly, and the thoughts that just come at us. And so the thoughts that just come at us are alien thoughts. Then the examples of the rabbis gave are what you said, being distracted by what people look like or what they're saying. Business, that you're in synagogue, but you're thinking about work. Right, exactly. I wonder if I have an email I need to check on. There's something I didn't get to. A thought that is not appropriate for the moment that you're in is an alien thought. I mean, you could be making love to your spouse and you have a thought about something else. That's an inappropriate thought for this moment, right? Eating at the dinner table with your kids and you're thinking about something else. I mean, this is what, you know, everyone wants to tell me. Rabbi, organized religion's just about controlling people, but you know, I practice the secret, or I practice some kind of new age thing, which is about living in the present moment. To which my response is, what do you think organized religion's about? Which is, do you think these are all just a bunch of structures meant to get people to donate money to the church so they get into heaven? Like, no. I mean, like, trust me, these structures wouldn't have existed unless they are tried and true methods of accomplishing those things. And so how do you live in the present moment? So the first thing you do is you spend pages and pages of just singing a little, being silent a little, singing a little, being silent a little, and slowly seesawing back and forth to try to get the alien thoughts out of your mind. And at some point, you get to the point where, fine, now what am I supposed to think and do? What does it mean to be in the present moment at 9:45 on a Saturday morning in Poway? And page 104 starts that, which is, okay, if you have gotten the alien thoughts out of your head, then this is your target. You have to march toward the first of three peaks in the service. So if you're drawing a diagram on the board, I'm going to go from right to left, like Hebrew, like the prayer book. You're basically, the service is going to look like this. It's like a walk through the hills. You're going to start on low ground, which is you're warming up. A little singing, a little silence, a little singing, a little silence. I'm trying to like get in the zone and get mindful. So then you're like, okay, I think you know, my muscles are working. I think I'm here. I don't have the stray thoughts. What's next for me? Okay, look ahead. You're going to have three peaks. One, two, three. The first one's going to be the Shema, our one line of Jewish creed. The second one's going to be the standing silent prayer. And the third one's going to be the Torah service of Mount Sinai, where you take the Torah out. So there is a contour, or whatever the word is. There's a topography. There's a topography to the service. And so you've crossed a few streams and done your warm-ups. And then between 104 and 111, so we have seven pages before we're going to get to the first peak. So let's talk about what the three peaks are. The Shema Yisrael is all, God is one. The Amidah is your personal time with God. You're going to stand. You're going to be completely silent. No one, despite the way congregants behave in synagogue, which is wrong, you're not supposed to talk or go to the bathroom or make any motions, even if you're not praying. It's supposed to create a period of utter silence. Many scholars, whether they're right or wrong, who knows? Many scholars believe that originally prayer, because we had sacrifice, and sacrifice didn't have any liturgy that went with it. So many scholars believe that the origin of what we do is actually silent meditation. Because if there was no liturgy that went with the sacrifice, then it would make sense that eventually evolved into silent reflection and contemplation. We know the Greeks were into meditation. We know other people were into meditation. So that it would make sense that there were groups that seemed to be historically preserved that were into silent meditation. So the second peak is the Amidah, which is the vestige. That's a terrible word. The preservation of silent meditation in the service. Not like, hey, everyone, silent meditation, I'll see you in a minute. But like really serious silent meditation that eventually became institutionalized, or as people like to say, the esoteric became the exoteric. You know what I mean? Yeah. So it's like these were esoteric groups that would meditate. This is not commonly done. And then when the service came together, people were like, well, we should do that. And people were like, no. That's this private thing for people to know how to do it. But it got co-opted. We're like, look, we'll stick the silent thing in there for people to know what they're doing. But we can't have two separate streams. You know, it can't be that there's the exoteric BS that the fisher folk do, and then there's the esoteric secret meditation. So it was a compromise, which you often see in the development of cultural structures. And so you have three peaks. The statement that God is one, the preservation of a silent time with God, and then the third one being, on Saturday morning, the reenactment of Revelation. So the third peak is, are you ready to receive Torah? So those are the three peaks. And that's going to be the topography that you walk in. So on 104, and you start with Nishmat Kol Chai Tivarech Et Shimcha Adonai Eloheinu at the top, which in the left says, the breath of all that lives praises you, Adonai, our God. So we are now on our way to the Shema. We are now on our way to God is one. And you start that by saying, okay, we've warmed up our voices, not all collectively, with tons of silence, right? A little singing, a little silence, a little teaching, a little silence, a little talking, a little silence. Then I got to get ready to that first peak. How am I going to get ready to say God is one? The first thing I'm going to say is that everything that is alive is already, is already praising you, Adonai, our God. So where it says our God, who's our? This is a crucial, so this is the big question of the Shema. When it says, the breath of all life praises you, Adonai, our God. Whose God is this?
Ours.
And who's our? Us Jews?
Us who have breath. and are alive.
Good. So this is all of us who have breath, who have the breath of life. Now, to me, this is already a step where I think 90% of Jews think we're already off target here. Like, so I'm often saying that we don't do a good job of Jewish education, and it's not about educating kids. We don't educate adults well, and most adult Jews are not interested in developing a prayer practice, honestly. They're jaded by modern society. And they already think this statement that we just came to is weird, even though it's the very first line we studied, which is the Shema is not just a statement as we Jews only believe in one God. It's rather a statement that there is one God that is the God of everything that is alive. And that's not just humans. That's the God of insects and the God of trees, everything that lives. So everything that has life in it.
Well, arguably, even the ground breathes.
And I completely agree. I think the ground definitely breathes. In fact, in at least a mock-up for the new prayer book, it had on the margins where it has readings, one of the readings was from Rabbi Nachman of Bratslav, where he says, how do you know if you're praying right? If you can hear the grass singing. And people are like, is that a Zen koan? Is that a fortune cookie? Is that poetry? And I'm like, I actually think he's being literal. He's saying that you really get to the point where you realize that the power of the words and the power of changing your mind is that we live in a massive ecosystem, and that everything is, but already we're last to the party. That's the whole thing, which is we think we're the most important things in the world, but the ant is more in touch with God. The bird is more in touch with God. The frog is more in touch with God, and the tree is already more in touch with God than we are. I truly believe that, because without sentience,
they live in a perpetual stream,
correct,
surrounded by the course of the entire universe.
Correct. They live in a perpetual stream surrounded by the course of the universe, and they know they're interconnected without knowing it. I mean, they know if I don't get oxygen, I die. They know if I don't get sunlight, I wither. Like, whereas you and I, we literally could live without love for 30 or 40 years and not really be aware of how much we're withering. And then we come to a massive realization and we don't understand why we have midlife crisis. And I'm like, you haven't been loved. I mean, you know, you got divorced when you were younger, you never married or whatever, you know, you lost someone to cancer. Of course you're withering. Like, a tree knows that in a day, you know, and I know that sounds poetic, but it's not poetic. It's the change of consciousness to say the Shema. It's the reality of it. And so already you're stepping into interconnectedness. You're stepping into humility because you're saying everything alive is, I want to be connected like that's connected. So, and then the next paragraph down says, could song fill our mouth and as water fills the sea, right? You see it for the first or the second,
yes.
Right? Now, the translation there is wrong. It doesn't say as water fills the sea. It actually, the Hebrew is, if song could fill our mouths as it fills the sea. And that to me tells me, it makes much more sense. But, so I get preachy because I'm like, even people that translate prayer books, I don't think know how
they
to pray.
Force it into what they consider to be the natural world rather than
correct,
the way things are.
Correct. And so my argument, I'm not just trying to be a know-it-all, is I actually think the people that have been translating our prayer books, and I think the people that have been teaching Jewish prayer, don't know anything about Jewish prayer. I don't think they know how to pray. And am I pretentious about it? Yeah, but I became a rabbi to be like, I want to, you know, it's sort of like interviewing an actor, and an actor says, I don't think people know how to act. You're not surprised when some actor is interviewed on the Actor Studio and says that. I don't think that this guy even knew how to translate. Like, I understand what he's doing, but the idea is now, think about that. Now we move to the sea, which, by the way, I was going to do a podcast on this at some point, but there was a study just released by, I forget who it was. I don't know if it was by the government. You know how these whales are beaching themselves? There's been a lot of mysterious life beachings over the last 20 years.
Yeah.
And they end up in these weird places, and then you have to cut them up in L.A. and the West Coast, and you're like, what happened? And some of them are pregnant, and you're like, are whales committing suicide? So a study came out that figured this out. And it just came out last week, which is that this is only affecting mammals, and it's affecting dolphins too, but mostly whales. And it has to do with sonar. It has to do, and oil rigs.
The songs are wrong.
We've created so much noise in the ocean that through sonar, through oil drilling, and through other forms of things, so those are the two main ones, that it's so loud to them that they're going literally insane, and they commit suicide from the insanity. So I just think it's amazing that we have a line here that says, the ocean is a natural ecosystem of song and of harmony, and the animals that live in it are in touch with that song. We're not. And we're so not in touch with that song that now we've ruined the song and we're killing animals in the process of some of the most, you know, the creatures in the sea that are most genetically related to us, the mammals. And we talk about the birds and the eagle's wings. And, you know, even if we could do that, we could never have full gratitude that you've lavished on us and our ancestors. Okay, I'm going to skip a little bit, and then we basically get to, so I think that's preparing us for the Shema, and I have a teaching that you may have heard, but in 105, at the end of the first paragraph, there's a quotation from the Psalms, where it says, we extol you, even as King David sang, praise Adonai my soul. Let every fiber of my being praise God's holy name. That's actually a decent translation. I actually think that in this preparation for saying God, everything's interdependent, God is all of our God, we have the breath of the life of the grass, the life of nature, we move to birds, we move to the ocean, and now we even move within. That there's like an
ecosystem.
Right.
As well, all the
exactly. That within us there's an ecosystem of mitochondria, of flora, of bacteria, of E. coli, and you know there's even a way of thinking today scientifically about you know the obvious that we are an ecosystem. We communicate endocrinologically, but the endocrine system is one of the things we least understand biologically at this point. I mean, anyone who has a thyroid issue knows we are basically medieval in our understanding of the chemicals that are released that help our organs communicate with one another. Because we are an ecosystem ourselves that is, in a way, singing to God, that is working in that present moment. So we go outside, we go inside, we go to the ocean, and then we go, by the way, it's right after that we say down the final paragraph where it says, among assembled throngs of the house of Israel, your name shall be glorified in song. So actually, in Hebrew, it's a little bit easier to see. It basically says, may the many kehilas, which means congregations, may the many congregations of the Israelites, of the people of Israel, like lift up their voices in song. I love that because we've gone nature, ocean, eagles, my body, all of these, the in the moment ecosystems, that are praising God already. And then you actually say, let all the congregations of Jews getting together on Saturday morning, let us be like those things. Let us be like a body, you know, like that we're a bunch of different people coming together to sing. Like my body is a bunch of different flora and mitochondria and organs coming together to sing. It's an incredible image, you know, that congregations should mimic an ecosystem. We are different people that complement each other, that are working together, that are trying to change the world according to this symbiotic pattern that God established in Torah. So it's pashut. It's simple. We go on, and then we have page 107. So page 107, as you probably know from my writings, it shifts to then, like we've already done that. We've done inside, outside, human. And animal and biological. So what's next? You probably heard me say, if you look at we all stand up for what's called the Baruch Hu. We all rise and we say, blessed, we're kind of, it's one of the first things that we're kind of saying out loud all together. Blessed be God. And then it says, may you, Adonai, be praised, our God, the ruler of the universe, as a tangent, let me just say that I don't translate melech as king, because we tend to think of a king as someone who is capricious. Right? The king is, oh, I hope the king forgives me. Oh, the king may decide to make a new tax. I mean, all the movies I watch and TV shows, kings are always like, what's the king going to decide today? The concept of God as king here is very, very different. God is the lawmaker of the universe. God is the God of physics. God's the God of science. Like, so I translate melech not as king, but as the rulemaker, like the lawmaker. So praised are you, our God, the lawmaker of the universe, the author of its laws, Yotzer Or, who fashions energy, Uvorei Choshech, and creates blackness. Choshech is utter darkness, voidness. I'll say utter darkness. Oseh Shalom, and through that creates, or through that does, makes shalom, peace, but let's call it harmony, which is another translation of it, creates a harmony. Uvorei et hakol, and out of that comes everything. So for me, this is where we head into physics. We've done before we're ready for our Shema, we're almost ready, we head into physics from biology. So now it becomes, wait a second, everything that's made of energy, which is everything, has a frequency. And so everything is made from sound. And think about what you were saying earlier. You were very kind to quote me from services, which is the most important thing in the priestly stratum of the Torah is that words create worlds. And that's the worlds that we live in, it come from from sound. And so here, we haven't even prayed yet. You know what I mean? This is the beautiful thing. We haven't even gotten to praying. Like, all of this is building up to be in the moment of being able to know what to do with words. And so now we're saying, don't forget, it's not just that everything alive is already making words. Like, I mean, making their versions of words, sounds. The whale song and the this and the that and the blood coursing through your veins. And to me, it's a language of, you know, of hormones, but sounds. And the grass is making sound. But here it's like, wait a second, it's all made up of, the worlds are made up of sounds.
The vibrations of strings.
Exactly. So can you think of physics as the vibrations of the chord box of God? That's exactly what I think of creation as. And other people are like, well, I don't believe in God because I don't believe like God talks. I mean, like, I don't mean God has a voice box like God talked to Mount Sinai through a loudspeaker. I mean that, like, you're talking about the fact that everything is made up of frequencies of sounds. And so, and that's what the prayer says. And this is an old prayer. So, you know, praised be our God, the rule maker of eternity, of the universe, who fashions energy and creates darkness, who makes these in harmony, and through that creates everything. I mean, lately I've been thinking also about dark matter. I mean, I don't want to get too obscure, but what's the Uvrei Choshech? That's the only part that I have trouble with in a way, which is what's the darkness it's talking about? I think of dark matter. I think of other kinds of
which is not perceptible as of now as a human being.
It's true. Or I think of nothingness, which is the idea of I don't want to pretend to know more than I do, but a lot of books came out in the last 4 or 5 years about the concept of whether nothing really exists. And there's this huge debate between two of the top physicists in the world. And it's gotten kind of very emotional and vehement, and they're writing articles back and forth, and I caught part of it, which is whether there is such a thing as nothing. Because if we can create the conditions of nothingness, things appear. Quantum particles appear. Subatomic particles appear.
That the silences, the rests in music define the notes about things.
And whether that could be extended to actually the way the universe works. So that, then think about, you're praying this. If you're really praying this, then you're saying, and I do, it's the silences that define the parts that are made. It's the nothingnesses out of which divine creation happens.
Even the rest in the silence aren't nothing, literally, because they're potential waiting for being.
Right. Right. And all of this is in the context of prayer. Like, all of this is like, this is the prayer practice. For most people, it's just a song. But that's not really what it is. Okay, let's turn the next page, 108. Wait, what?
I don't see what this word says.
Which one?
Starts with a B sound.
Oh, read it.
I don't know the last letter.
Which one? Up here?
The last sound.
Or that? That's a final. It's a final chaf. So baruch.
I can see it up to that letter.
That's awesome. No, you're making. So then we literally have a song on page 108, and it is a mystical song. Do they give a date for it in here? Yeah, well, I'm looking for the date. Because it was.
It does not say so anywhere. On this page.
It was written by a Jewish mystic, and they put it here because it makes sense. It starts with creation reflects the will of God, who is praised by the breath of all life, which we talked about a little bit. But then it completely goes into the energy stuff. And the English translation here doesn't do it justice. So what it basically says is, well, I'll try to go with some of it. God's greatness and goodness fill the universe. But it talks about basically a chayot hakodesh, a life in the holy realms.
That sounds like this sound that people sing when they're singing holy.
That's right, Kodesh. That's right. And then it says, "V'nedar b'chavod al hamerkava," that God's presence is glorified or appears. Some of these English words I just hate, but because they don't convey what I'm praying. What I pray is that God's presence, the kavod, the manifestation of God, manifests al hamerkava. Upon, and the Merkava is Ezekiel's chariot. So you can say this translation is just not dealing with it, but God's presence is manifested on the chariot. Now, you could be like, what? But that's all good, because one of the most unbelievable parts of the Torah is, it's not the Torah, it's in the prophets, is when Ezekiel has the vision of the chariot of God riding through the sky. And no one else is seeing it. So you could say he's crazy, right?
So he's slightly out of sync and seeing timeless time.
He's seeing timeless time. I mean, now think about where this goes. You've transitioned from, even if someone could say, okay, the birds are making some sounds. Fine. Whatever. But now we're in the energy thing. The energy stuff is making sounds. What? So he's like, how about Ezekiel? Ezekiel saw God's presence in the world where everyone else just sees blue sky. So that, and it's, it, so it, you know, like, I don't view it as literal anthropomorphic kind of bad prayer. Like, oh, God's in the sky. Thank you, God. Don't forget about me. You know, please heal me of my cold. It's a whole nother thing. It's like, you don't even know the world you're living in. We're going to quote the one part of the Bible where more than anywhere, if you want to try to tell someone, there is more going around you. There's more going on around you than you see. You can't pick something better than Ezekiel saying, I'm watching the chariot go by with all the colors and the sounds and the deafening roar of it. And you're like, are you okay, dude? I don't see anything. And he's like, it's the whole thing. Can you hear the sounds of the superstrings vibrating? Can you hear the sounds, the frequencies of the electrons and the subatomic particles? No. It doesn't mean it's not a deafening roar. I mean, when you think about it, we still live in the Big Bang. The Big Bang didn't stop.
It did. They can hear it. They've got the telescope.
And so that's what that's exactly what I think about of this, which is exactly, they can still hear it with the telescopes. I mean, just to like blow your mind even more, I mean, you may know this already, but this is a very big deal, which is there are three big concepts that recur frequently in Jewish structures: creation, redemption, and revelation. And I won't go into a long discourse about it now, but what I will say about that is that these are three huge concepts for us: creation, redemption, and revelation. And what the rabbis tell us is that if you want to take a step to religious maturity, to spiritual maturity, I should teach this in the school. I'm always wondering what I can do with the kids that's not above them, but that's not talking down to them. Then a step to spiritual maturity is to say that creation is ongoing, and revelation is ongoing, and redemption is ongoing. Now, the Christians came up with stuff like, yeah, I mean, Jesus can save you right now. And in that sense, they're not so far away from us. Like, that's one area, if I was doing comparative religions, I'd be like, this is a worthy essay for someone to do for their term paper for comparative religion classes. Because, that, you know, they would say God's grace is available to you at any moment or something like that. We have a very similar concept. But the rabbis are very clear. Creation was not an historical event. It is what you and I call nature. Like, nature didn't happen a long time ago. Nature is still happening. You couldn't be a scientist without going in. If you're going to go study nature, it's still happening around you. And the rabbis said this way before we had a concept of nature like we have now. They said, don't think of creation as a moment in history. Think of it as when you study creation, you're studying nature, and it is still happening. And then they also said the same thing about Revelation, which is the reason we get to the third part, which is the Mount Sinai part, which I know we haven't gotten to yet. But the third part is, don't think of Revelation as something that happened 3,000 years ago to 3,300 years ago. Like, that's the wrong way to think of it. We are not all here. Exactly. Revelation is enlightenment. Revelation is changing your life because you realize what's true and what's right. So that the Torah was a vehicle for ongoing revelation. The idea that we have to remember what God said a long time ago because it was very important to them. And, you know, like, no, that's like, it's not a history lesson. Correct.
Studying.
This isn't a museum. And it's very sad because a lot of Jews have turned services and synagogue into nostalgia for the past. It's like, it's just the opposite. And redemption comes up on Passover.
Well, they need to read this book.
Right. Well, right, because it comes up at the holidays. And Passover is about the fact that it's not like the redemption just happened under Ramses in Egypt. Like, redemption is an ongoing freedom to serve God, which has all kinds of dimensions of the present. Okay, I'm going to go back to this because I want to get through a bunch. And so if we go back to this, the Merkavah, this deafening roar that Ezekiel talks about is actually going on around us through this fashioning of energies. And then it says that Chesed v'rachamim lifnei kivodo, God is surrounded by mercy and love. I better not do the whole thing. So let me figure out how one does. Let me go to the third line. Go to where in English it says, good are the lights our God has created. Okay? Fashioning them with insight and wisdom. The lamest translation in the world. So that Tovim Odor means great are the stars. I mean, I like the stars. I don't know about the lights. You know what I mean? The lights make it sound like God turned on the lights. Obviously, if we're talking about the sound of energy, then it's better to say Tovim Odor, great, good are the stars, Shebara Eloheinu, that God created, Yitzaram b'da'at b'vina v'skel. They shape energy, or energy is formed through them, according to da'at v'vina v'skel, according to principles of knowledge, distinguishment, and wisdom.
That's hardly fair. Your way is like blueprints to the universe, and this way is like, let's just say nice things.
Correct. Thank you. That's exactly my argument. And I know it's a little bit arrogant, but it's like, I just don't know how anyone could pray this. Like, exactly.
Coming from background, it can't pray it easily.
Correct. Correct. It's we've turned the prayer book into a hymnal, and it's not what it is. So that if we're talking about God, who is the lawmaker, then all of this is constructed according to laws. We want to find our place in those laws. We understand we're surrounded by these laws, and we're surrounded by a universe that's vast and interconnected, and that's alive.
In the way that you said it, it was talking about how the stars themselves, in their outpouring of energy, abide by certain rules, and not only that, but they have agency in following said rules.
Correct, and I mean, because agency doesn't have to mean free will.
No.
Right?
No.
See, no, because it's important. Agency could be like, the molecules of life were birthed out of the stars. I mean, you know, and then so, and that's really important. I mean, when we're right now looking at Jupiter and we're looking at these different planets, we're sending out probes and we're doing spectrography and stuff. We're trying to understand is, can we find the elements that are necessary for life being produced by stars around the galaxies? And you know what I mean? Like, and how, so it is, by the way, the next line is, Mleim Zivum Fikim Noga. There is this radiance, this radiation of energy. The universe is filled with a radiation. It's full of radiation. And I'm like, wow, my daughter, by the way, is named after that. So the feminine form of Ziv is Ziva, and that's my second daughter, and it means radiant energy. And people are like, oh, that's so cool. You mean like she's pretty, she radiates. Now I'm like, no, that's the hymnal version. The hymnal version is, it's pretty. The non-hymnal version is, I know radiation is a bad word ever since nuclear power, but like, we live in a universe of radiant energy that makes up everything, and that connects me to God.
Actually, it's a sad fallacy. People who are not from the nuclear power community think that. People from the nuclear power community think of awesome power and greatness as it comes to nuclear power and
radiation. I mean, you know, one thing that amazes me is that, and I don't understand nuclear power as well as I should, but if I understand something correctly, so you'll tell me if I don't, right? It's just something very, very basic, which is if enough of a naturally occurring isotope is collected.
They have natural reactors in Africa. That's what you're asking.
No.
Oh, like literally, they have
yes. So you saw where I was going with it, which is I never until about 2 months ago, maybe it was a month ago. Yeah, I was watching a movie that dealt with nuclear power, and I had this like revelation or whatever insight. That, wow, so basically, if you collect enough of this material that's naturally occurring, it's just naturally hot.
Yeah.
It's just like, and it's portable in a sense. Like, in other words, there are natural hot springs that come from the earth. Okay, that's fine. And a lot of California runs on geothermal power. We don't talk enough about geothermal power. But this is kind of like portable geothermal power. It's like, this stuff is just naturally crazy hot. So
the exact versions of it for the Army.
Right.
I mean, before they realized, you know, probably we should do this to our people.
Correct. It's the radiation's in. But like, that's so cool. You can collect materials naturally hot that will boil water and create energy. And okay. So we're at the stars. We connect those with, and now I'm going to skip a bunch. Page 109. We are really close now to getting ready to say the Shema. All of this is preparation for whether we can say, how many words is this? Is it 8 words? Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. 6 words. All of this is whether we can say 6 words. So for people who are like, we've already sung a couple of songs, blah, blah, it's all about whether you can be in the moment to say 6 words correctly. And most people can't. Like, I mean, like, that's the standard the service is holding up. So we're not there yet. Right. But and even just the right. I mean, like, you know, we say I love you. And do we even mean it? We say I'm sorry. Do we even mean it? You know, we say I'm grateful. Do we even mean it? There's no one who wrote better for me about prayer than, and we'll read some together. Abraham Joshua Heschel is just, I mean, he was off the charts thinker. One of the greatest ever produced by our species. But one thing is, you know, he's like, it's like the problem.
What is that person? Little small one.
It's a yud. It's a Y. The little small with the dot in the middle. Don't ignore the dot. You and I have to talk about the dot sometime. No, we do. But it's so by yom, on the day. But one thing Heschel said was that, and he said it very, very well, is people say that the problem with the prayer is the words. There are too many. Even me, I'm crazy. The problem with the prayer is the words. It's like, the problem with prayer is us. And he said, and it's that we don't even, like, we can't even say one word. He's like, can you really say the word gratitude? Like, can you say I'm grateful and mean it? Can you say I'm sorry and mean it? Can you say it's beautiful and mean it? Can you say, God forbid, we should use, like, an incredibly important word to Judaism, which is awe? Yeah, you know, like, oh, God, we're awestruck. Yeah, God, I have awe. Which occurs, you have awe? Really? Like, can you even say the word wonder? Can you say the word honor? Can you say any of that? And it's more than this random alien thought association. Can you actually say it and know it and own it? So all we're trying to get to is to own the words, listen, Israel, our God is one. You know, and can you get there?
Facebook. Yep. My heart's broken.
Right.
My heart breaks for you. My heart's just shattered.
Right.
Do you even know what you're saying? You say that when little Junior breaks their elbow, you say that when 10 people are murdered.
Good. So this goes back to the words. Like, if prayer, it's operating on multiple, the service is operating on multiple levels at once. One of the levels it's operating on is trying to get you to realize that you're careless with your words. And for you to say, I'm heartbroken, and you're not heartbroken, you have changed the world that you inhabit, you have diminished it. You've diminished yourself, and you have lowered your ability to operate in the world. If our greatest weapon, our greatest tool, again, you don't have to believe this. I'm saying the rabbi, most of the rabbis of the Talmud said it was language. Some said it was intelligence. Some said it was the ability to have logic, memory. But like, if it's words, yeah.
The damage to a garden.
Right.
They're setting themselves up to not even be able to comprehend greater pains in their life and properly proportion them.
Correct. So, if our greatest gift is not our thumb. It is. Come in.
Hey. Hey.
Becky says we rescheduled.
Okay, I didn't know what that was.
No, thanks for telling me.
Okay. Do you have Shay coming in about 10 minutes?
Thank you for reminding me.
Do you have time to talk for a second to Alex and Roland, who's starting his first Bar Mitzvah lesson?
Not until then. Not until, like, when would I do that?
Between like now and 3 o'clock.
Is he out there?
Yeah.
I got to finish this though. Okay. That's the problem. I mean,
I'm hoping you will pop in.
I'll try to. I will pop in.
Okay.
But I can't pop in the next 5 minutes. No, I want to finish my thought. If our greatest gift is words, the ability to use words to communicate with each other and to inhabit words and to use words to create a world that allows us to fulfill our and God's purposes, then the service is partly a medium for you to get to realize how careless we are with our words and how we diminish ourselves through their use. In a way, the best thing that could come out of the service is that you walk out being largely silent. Not, I don't mean like when you're socializing, but that you go back into your life focused and in the present moment so that the words you use in those moments are real words and they're not random and they're not careless. And in a way, sure, it's trying to accomplish what a good yoga session or meditation session involves, but it's to realize that it's to change the way you function when you come out of the service. Now, I realize we're short on time, so I just want to say on 109, I take this page to basically say one main thing, which is it's on the day of Shabbat that we take the time to listen to all this, to appreciate all this. I mean, we should pray every day, but this is a longer service. This is the big service, right? So on this big service, we're not just rushing into these things. We've had a lot of pages, and we still haven't said our Shema yet. Like, that's crazy. You know what I mean? We've been in services now for whatever, half an hour, and we haven't even really been given permission to praise God yet, in a way. I mean, yeah.
You know, if you're going to state out loud who you're asking, you're going to want to know and have a concept of what you're exactly saying.
Exactly. And so this is a slight reminder that thank God for Shabbat. Because on Shabbat, there's no rushing. Like, we don't have to rush on Shabbat. It's one of my biggest problems with people who say, well, my favorite way to celebrate Shabbat is to go to the beach or to do this or do that. My attitude is, but if you're rushing around, it's not Shabbat. Shabbat is about tremendous patience. And that, you know, and so, that, you know, you shouldn't be like, I'm rushing here and I'm rushing there. In any case, we get to page 110. We quote from Ezekiel and Isaiah, but mostly from Ezekiel. And we bring in the idea that there is an invisible realm filled with God's presence that we don't normally experience. And then we go to page 111, which is that basically God loves us, and God loves us through this cosmic love. That comes through the universe. I know we could talk more about that, but then 112. We finally made it. We've been scaling that wall through biology and physics and words, and then we made it, and right before we hit the peak, we're looking around saying, this is love. When you feel this invisible universe around us that's actually so loud, you feel the love of it. You're not alone. You're connected to everything. So that's the kind of ahava rabba. You're connected to everything. And then you get to 112 and you can say your six words, which is, listen, Israel, the God of whose name we don't pronounce is our God. And that God is one, is singular. And to me, what I normally pray, and maybe someday I'll give a sermon saying I've been praying it all wrong all these years, is that I'm saying it's when we listen, we Jews, we realize that everything has the same God, and that God is this one interconnected system in which every action affects the whole system, and we are all interconnected. And a lot of what we think of as our individual needs and wants and our little bubbles we walk around in is not from the perspective of God. We're one voice in a symphony. We are privileged to have the sentience to be able to understand that we live in that system. I mean, I do believe the tree and the cricket and the bird is connected to the system naturally, but we are given the sentience of actually knowing that we live in one interconnected system. And that is completely extraordinary. Which one? Echad. Echad means, it's literally the word for one, but most Bible scholars will tell you that here, the best English translation would be singular, because the English word singular captures.
This is alone, and I don't like it.
Oh, yeah, I don't like that either. But then again, people don't like my translation. I would translate it, Here, Israel, Adonai, our God, Adonai is singular, which is a little awkward, but exact. The word Echad in Hebrew expresses uniqueness.
The manner in which that's punctuated and the manner in which the words flow to say that.
I agree. So we could have more to say about that.
Sorry, I guess.
No, it's okay. I'll tell you what, let's pick up there next time, which is that we've made it to the first peak, and then we have two more peaks to make in the service. Fair enough?